K. Clarenbach, September 29th, 1987. Continuation of Side 2. K., last week we talked about your high school experience. After graduation from high school, what next?
Well, of course, I worked that summer, as I've already mentioned, doing my two little mundane jobs, playing golf as often as I could, and then enrolled in the fall at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. That was a choice that I made without really examining very many alternatives. I just really wanted to go to Madison. And the year that I was a freshman, my next older brother had decided to transfer from La Crosse, where he had had his freshman year, which was then a state college, and to go to the University in Madison. This was 1937, and things were not flush in the Frederick household. Well, my third brother was, David, was about to enter his sophomore year in high school. And my family thought about this for a while. My brother Bob was thinking about transferring to Madison. He had had 1 year there, but he was kind of a nomad, I think. He had a year at Carroll College and a year at La Crosse. He hadn't flunked out. He just simply thought he would like another institution better. So there was an outside possibility that three of us would be enrolled in Madison, and with a fourth coming up soon. So my parents made the decision, and I rather think it was my mother who made the decision, to move herself and enough furniture to Madison to establish an apartment. My father would stay in Sparta in the big house by himself and conduct his life as usual. I think part of that decision, although it was never explicit at all on my mother's part, was really to get out of Sparta. And she had always enjoyed Madison. She had friends here. And whenever we had come to Madison, or she had come by herself, she'd always had particularly good times. So that's what we did. Rented an apartment at 440 West Dayton Street. The building is still there, although neighboring buildings are not any longer there. On the third floor, they even moved my baby grand piano up, and that was some enterprise to watch while they heisted with ropes from the outside of the building. In any case, about the time we moved, Brother Bob, number one, decided not to come to Madison. So there were just Gordon and me in the university, and David, who went to what was then called Central High School, the MATC building, part of which has recently been torn down. Same building my father went to high school in. It was then called Madison High and was the only high school in town when he was in school. Well, for one semester, we lived in the apartment, and my brother and I, and we all were doing our things in school. But by the end of the semester, it just wasn't working out. My father was terribly lonely, and I think it was difficult for my mother. I'm sure that just climbing those stairs was more difficult. And she didn't have the access to a car. Even though she wasn't driving, she could be driven any place in Sparta. I don't know what all of the considerations were, but in any case, she moved lock, stock, and barrel back to Sparta at the end of the first semester. David was very happy to return to his old friends in high school in Sparta, although he'd been an awfully good sport about his move. And Gordon and I had to find a place to live. And that's one of the reasons that we each joined a fraternity. I joined the Alpha Chi Omega sorority and he the Kappa Sigma fraternity, even though that was not, you know, we were ambivalent about that. But
why?
The dormitories were filled and we needed a place to stay, and the idea of a room in a rooming house was just abhorrent, I suppose, to both of us. And we had friends in those organizations.
Why were you ambivalent about joining?
Well, because the whole Greek system is a very exclusionary one, and discriminatory, and sometimes a little bit upstage. I found many wonderful friends in that sorority house, some of whom I'm still friendly with. One came from Washington, D.C., and another from Milwaukee for the three of us to have a little reunion here in town this summer.
Oh.
So we still are, you know, in touch. But in any case, I lived there then for 3.5 years mm-hmm. in the sorority house.
Mm-hmm.
I can recall several of my senior year, I was president of the sorority house, and my junior year, I had been corresponding secretary. And in that capacity, I not only had access, but had to read correspondence with national officers and previous officers of the local chapter, and came across one letter regarding me. Apparently, I was being considered the year before to be nominated for the presidency, which I didn't know anything about. And some comment in the correspondence was, but we're never sure what she might drag into the house. I was very active in International Club, and I chaired the University Peace Federation for 4 years and was vice president of the YWCA, and had many friends who were not traditional Greek and WASPs, and so that's what the comment was about.
Do you think in your time there that you politicized your sisters in any respect?
Oh, I'm sure. As a matter of fact, there were a few of us who connived among ourselves very consciously. We didn't start out to think of it as politicizing, but the table conversation was so boring and superficial, unless there were two or three of us who found each other more interesting than the others, who would rush to the dining room so that we could sit together. We would save seats for one another simply to have a reasonable conversation. One of them, Ruth Thompson, who is now married to and has been for years to Bowden Curtis, and the two of them have run a couple of rural newspapers down in Darlington. And she was a very, and her brother ran for governor of Wisconsin unsuccessfully, but was a state senator for 20 or 30 years. So she came from a very politically alert and just interested in public affairs. She had a subscription to the Capital Times. And believe it or not, it just wasn't customary for students anywhere that I knew of, very many of them, to feel the need to read a daily newspaper. I mean, they would read the student newspaper, but to know what was happening in the real world was beyond them. And of course, this was before the era of television, and on Saturday afternoon I would often sit in the little lounge with a friend and listen to the opera on radio, but there was no television and no addiction to daily news or certainly to reading newspapers and magazines. So in any case, three or four of us set out to improve the table conversation, and we would give it some thought before a meal. What subject could we raise that would make an interesting kind of discussion? And it wasn't long before other people would drift to our table and want to sit with us because they found the conversation more interesting. Mm. And by the end of, or before the end of a year, I remember a national officer came to visit or inspect the chapter or whatever, and that was one of her primary comments, that it was the most interesting and alert conversation. She didn't know that it had been carefully nurtured and cultured, but so I suppose, and then women in the sorority house did meet all kinds of my friends from International Club from all over the world, and instead of being horrified, you know, they gradually found this interesting.
Tell me about your academic life. Did you know initially what your major would be?
No, I didn't. And I did something that I may have done in many other contexts all my life. And I think, in retrospect, it was very foolish. I deliberately avoided courses which had been such a snap for me in high school. I decided not to take speech courses or to even attempt to be on the debate team. These were things that I had done and had done successfully, and I thought, well, now I want to do something different. I didn't take courses such as physics. I think I mentioned previously what fun Mary Cornell and I had had in high school, mm-hmm. using that extra period. And so I moved into areas that were foreign to me. I had a couple friends, again in the sorority house, who were majoring in anthropology, and they kept trying to interest me, not in my freshman year, but at some point, into taking anthropology because they found it so fascinating. Two of these women have made a career in anthropology and have done fascinating things over the years, but I enrolled in one anthropology course, and the very first day or the first reading left me so cold that I transferred out of it right away. Hmm. Now again, that was a mistake, I think. If I had it to do over again, mm-hmm. that's an area that I would really, cultural anthropology.
Mm-hmm. Was Margaret Mead in the news yet at that time? Or were you aware?
Well, I read, I don't really know. I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't
My
either.
First memory of reading anything about Margaret Mead was actually during World War II. Reading the article called And Keep Your Powder Dry. Now, Margaret Mead had her 80th or 85th birthday 10 years ago. We celebrated it at the Houston Conference. She was there, and the whole 2,000 delegates stood up and sang happy birthday to Margaret Mead, and it was lovely. That was not too long before she died. Well, that means that Margaret Mead was 30-some years older than I am, mm-hmm. so she was certainly publishing by the time I was an undergraduate.
I was just wondering what her influence might have been on female students in the field at that time, but perhaps she wasn't well enough known yet.
Well, at least not to me and not to my circles.
Okay.
Now, you asked about my academic... I chose to study a little more German. I'd had 2 years of German in high school, which is the equivalent of 1 year at the university. And I had a very exciting experience during my very first semester when a professor of German invited me to have a part in the Christmas play. Apparently the German club every year did some kind of a Christmas dramatic performance, and I was quite excited to be invited. Later on I found out that most everybody else in the performance and in the organization were graduate students, and I was just a freshman. I realized that the man was typecasting. He thought my pronunciation of German was good, which was one reason, but also the most peculiar Christmas play I have ever heard. I was Die Frau Wirtin. I was the landlady where the shepherds came and spent the night. The only other woman was the Virgin Mary, of course. That was not I. But I was trying to keep the shepherds from getting too drunk at my tavern so they'd still be able to go on and greet the baby Jesus. It was a very peculiar play. It was lots of fun to do. And I probably had more B pluses than any undergraduate who ever attended the university. I thought I was just assumed I was a good student, but as I told you earlier, I had never taken a final exam mm-hmm. until I came to the university. So I had no idea how to prepare for a final exam. And I would always did my classwork and recited in class and was actually generally doing A work, got A on my papers, but when it came to a final exam, I didn't do A work. And so I would get these B pluses, which was a great chagrin to me. Also, I had been all through high school kind of a big frog in a little pond. Mm-hmm. And I came to the university where there were, at the time, 10,000 students. And You know, my whole town was 3,500 people. And I felt very conspicuous. I felt kind of country and overgrown. And most of the gals, we called them gals in those days instead of women, at the sorority house were not only much better off financially, much better, and their wardrobes and their experiences, some of them had cars, made me feel, again, a little, they didn't do anything to me or say anything that suggested that I didn't fit in. But I felt very conspicuous and as though I were not properly dressed. Or
How did your parents pay for this? There were two of you then.
Yes.
And in a fraternity and a sorority.
Mm-hmm. Well, I believe that the room and board was $30 a month. That was not much more than dormitory, the cost of living in a dormitory. Mm-hmm. And that's that and our tuition. And my dad also insisted that we each have a season ticket to the athletic events and a season ticket to the theater concerts at the Union Theater. And those things he paid for. And then anything else we had to take out of our own earnings and our own savings. Mm-hmm. So if I ever wanted a Coke or what else. Mm-hmm. So
tape number 3, Kay Clarendon. Kay, we were talking about your college experience.
Yes. Well, I guess I was pointing out which courses I enrolled in and what I eschewed and why.
Well, and I was wondering if you felt academically inadequate or less adequate in such a huge institution, if that played a factor at all.
Well, I encountered new ideas, and I had to study for the first time, not only prepare for exams, but which I didn't learn to do until about my junior or senior year. Had to really study. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of my reading of textbooks, for example, in the student union, in the Paul Bunyan room, which was the only room that women were allowed to go into. We couldn't go into the Rathskeller or, we could go upstairs in the meeting rooms, could and did, but for refreshments.
Why weren't you allowed in those other rooms?
Because there was sex-based discrimination in the student union. We were at least allowed in the front door. In earlier year days, well before my time, there was a special back door that women had to walk into to get into the building. And I do remember being irked that we couldn't go into the great big Rathskeller. And so that when I would get a refill on my coffee cup, black coffee was 3 cents a cup in those days, and second cups were free. So that's how I learned to drink coffee. I didn't really like it, but it was the cheapest thing to buy. And one cup and 3 cents worth would last me the whole afternoon. So I did a lot of my reading down there. It just seemed, well, then I would be ready to go to meetings. I belonged to quite a few organizations. And so I don't know that I really felt inadequate. I often found a good student in the class with whom I would study. At least there were a number of courses in which I found that a good thing to do. And we would just kind of gravitate to each other, people that I only met in the classroom. So that there were not, while there were a few big lecture classes, we always then had small discussion groups. And so that the classroom situation wasn't a formidable one at all. Mm-hmm. It was rather nice. And I was just thinking of some of the people that I studied, but I don't know that bears remarking about. I did have an interesting experience in a geography course, a 5-credit geography course, which had a lot of tedious we had, I think, two-hour called labs. Now, there were a number of field trips that were terribly exciting in geography. We went to Devil's Lake and looked at, glaciated things, and some of that was quite interesting. But in the laboratory itself, we had to sit and draw maps of rainfall and of other such things. Really kindergarten activity. Well, it didn't take long before four or five of us in this geography lab decided to combine forces. And one, each of us would draw one rainfall map, and then the others would copy it quickly. And then we'd have enough, and we couldn't leave when we were finished. We had to sit there for the 2 hours. So then we would sit and talk. Well, among the people that I talked with were Raleigh Day, who's now a Supreme Court Justice, and Charlie's last name, who's an attorney here in town, Jim Hudson, who lives in the Milwaukee area, who was a very progressive left-wing kind of person, who taught me more about politics, or at least I learned more, sitting in that miserable geography lab and visiting with him. And it was he who persuaded me to belong to the University Peace Federation, and to which I was promptly elected chair or president, whatever. We brought Harold Lasky from England to address the university student body under the auspices of the Peace Federation. I can remember that was the first time I bearded the lion's den, the president of the university, to ask permission to do this and to ask for funding from the university.
And you were successful.
Yes, and that was the first year that Clarence Addison Dykstra was here as president of the university. We had the meeting when Harold Lasky came in the old Red Gym. That was one of the big places, big enough to have a meeting of that kind. And I can remember my brother Gandhi, a.k.a. Gordon, was in the audience, and he was so, he didn't know I was going to be introducing Harold Lasky. We could have been doing a Charlie McCarthy stunt because Harold Lasky came barely to my shoulder. Anyway, my brother just about died of embarrassment because there I was in this spotlight. And any time I did anything that was kind of, or at least in those days, kind of public, would just embarrass him, just as it had in third and fourth grade when I would raise my hand too long. Anyway, those were among, I did, I'm sure I spent more time in extracurricular activities, which in itself were wonderful educational experiences for me. Meeting the not only the kinds of people and the kinds of issues. Ed Nestigan was a person who was on the staff of the YMCA at that time. He was from Sparta. And he made it his business, apparently, every year to tap four or five freshmen who looked promising in leadership, and then to kind of groom us without our knowing his full agenda, of course. So he would have little meetings, and Bob Lampman, who was on our faculty and has chaired the economics department, was one of those, and I was one, and a fellow named John Bossert, who is now an attorney over in La Crosse. We were three of the little handful from our class whom Ed, can remember now asking him, and that was 55 years ago. Years ago. How in the world he could read a newspaper as fast as he could, because I had never really read a daily paper as a regular thing.
You promise?
All through my high school years. Yeah. So it was only at the when I came here that I began to do that. And I can remember Ed very patiently kind of walking me through a paper and telling me how he would look at a headline and decide it was nothing he wanted to read, or read the opening paragraph if he had a little interest, and then, you know, read the whole thing if it was something else. And now that's a skill.
Well, I
that
guess
ought to
you
be taught.
It one time, David,
and I don't know.
Not
maybe they teach it in journalism or English, but it ought to be taught in high school.
Gerda teaches it in her history classes. It's the first time that I have come across it being taught. Yes.
Anyway, I'm sure that Ed Nestigan was another influence in my concerns. And I spent some time in an open housing committee. Madison, in those days, was far worse than it is now. Mm-hmm. When Paul Robeson came to Madison to perform in the Union Theater in Othello, he could not stay in any hotel in Madison.
Okay. Where did he stay?
He stayed at the Hagen residence. Gunter Hagen was in the performance with him, and her parents were here. Her father was on the faculty. And so,
he
had a place to stay. Okay. Otherwise, I suppose some black man in town would have put him up. But it's hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did
you go to the performance?
Oh, indeed.
Tell me about the performance, just as an aside here.
I don't know what to tell, except it was just terrific.
What was the audience's response? Were any black people able to come in? Could they afford the tickets, for example?
I have no memory of how many black people were or were not in the audience. They certainly would have been permitted in. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were black students on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
I met Hilton Hanna, who has since been a labor leader with the International Brotherhood of Meat Cutters and whatever the total title
mm-hmm.
is.
Mm-hmm.
He has moved back to Madison in recent years, but I can remember eyebrows being raised when he and I would take a walk across the Bascom Hill, but that was all. I mean, nobody said, made any mm-hmm. slurring remarks. He was a student in economics mm-hmm. at the time.
Was it unusual that you, as a woman, were involved in all these things? You've mentioned a lot of men who were involved with you, but you haven't mentioned other young women.
There were other women who were active in Peace Federation and open housing, and I don't know how close I was with any of them. Usually the secretary of any of these organizations would be a woman, and I would work with her. And there were women on the newspaper staff of the Daily Cardinal who covered things and would be in touch with me a lot, and with whom I, had a lot of contact and relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But by about my junior year, I became quite friendly with a fellow by the name of Jerry Kaiser from New York, and in fact, we dated fairly steadily for 5 years here in Madison, and then when I went to Washington during World War II with the War Production Board, he was also in Washington. He had some friends, also mostly from New York. His friends were in graduate school. Joe Peckman, who a few years ago got an honorary degree from the university, and with whom I've stayed in touch, and Ben Stefanski, who later became a labor attaché to our embassy in Mexico, and some very, very interesting people, and quite intellectually active. And so I spent a lot of time with this crowd. Now, it wasn't just all those men and me. I mean, those other men had dates and were friends, mm-hmm. friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, I suppose I had kind of a compartmentalized undergraduate time of having a lot of good friends at the sorority house, and some of us would rush every noon and have a short game of bridge with the woman who was house mother, and before we had to rush to our 1:30 class. So I had very good friends there. Then another gang, in the International Club, and then some of this left-wing progressive peace and housing kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
And they might or might not mingle
mm-hmm.
or know one another. And,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel fragmented at all.
Mm-hmm.
It all made sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taking a lot of social studies, social science
uh-huh.
courses. And I might just mention that the reason I chose to major in political science as an undergraduate was that in the course of a junior year, students were required to name a major and have X number of credits and related credits, etc. And political science had the fewest required courses of any of those subject areas that I found interesting. So I thought, why not? Then I could take whatever additional things I wanted.
Hmm. Well, that relates to the question that I wanted to ask you next. How did you experience the classroom? Gloria Steinem in Everyday Acts and Outrageous Rebellions, or vice versa, states that college women experience the least discrimination of any group of women. I wonder if that was the case in your day, that you find that in college life it's easier to be equal than when you move into the work world, etc.
I wasn't conscious of sex-based discrimination.
How did the faculty, I assume, were primarily male, or is that a correct assumption at that time?
In my case, yes. That is a correct assumption, and it was particularly true for me. By that I mean I had very few women instructors at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had one woman full professor, Helen Clark, in social work. So actually, the School of Social Work had not been founded yet. She founded it, or was instrumental mm-hmm. in getting one started here. But I took social legislation, I took group work theory and practice, casework theory and practice, because I wanted more of what she had to offer. And she and I stayed in contact and friends after I moved away from that. She sat on my orals committee for my master's degree and for my PhD. And kind of, in some ways was kind of a surrogate resident mother for me. I'm sure if at the time I'd said that to her, she wouldn't have liked it probably very much. She was 25 or so years older than I am. And when we moved back to Madison 27 years ago, I got in touch with her, and she had us over at her house for parties, particularly when her brothers would be in town. Then she moved out to the Attic Angels and had a little apartment. That's a residence for elderly people, very nice one. And then as she got older and couldn't maintain the apartment, she moved into their whatever it's called, infirmary or mm-hmm. Or nursing home facility, really. She died a year ago, a little over a year ago, and I was asked and did speak at her memorial service, which was very nice.
Yes, what a long history.
In 1960, the women's 1980, when I was 60, in 1980, mm-hmm. the women's studies program on the campus had a birthday party for me at the Wisconsin Center, and Helen Clark came in a wheelchair. The young man who was her driver and attendant brought her, and that was so wonderful for me to have her there and be able to introduce her as the one female professor I had in all my years as an undergraduate and graduate. Now, there were other women professors here. Gladys Borchers in the speech department, Helen C. White, for whom the building mm-hmm. is named, in the mm-hmm. English department, mm-hmm. who was an absolutely marvelous, gorgeous woman, the most beautiful posture, and she always wore lavender or purple, every item of clothing I think she had, and she just was such a figure, as well as a brain, of course. Mm-hmm. And she was once, I think maybe both of them, in turn, were advisors to Mortar Board, which is a senior women's honorary society to which I belonged and of which I was president. So I did have opportunities to meet these, another woman in the English department. So there were, you know, maybe half a dozen mm-hmm. women professors mm-hmm. around, but you could count them on your hand.
Do you think that you consciously saw them as role models?
No, I don't think so. I know that I enjoyed being with them, and I admired them. The Dean of Women at the time, Louise Troxell, mm-hmm. was also somebody that I liked spending time with.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether, I guess I never thought about mm-hmm. that wasn't part of one's vocabulary, and maybe of one's, you know, I can't think of ever saying to myself, gee, I want to grow up to be just like you know, that person. Mm-hmm.
Were they married women? And I ask the question because I'm wondering if a married woman could actually balance
not
a profession.
Any of those people was married. Helen Clark did marry, when she was in her 40s, a man who was widowed and had one daughter who was either finishing high school or starting university, I don't know which. But that marriage only lasted a couple of years, and then they were divorced. The other women I named were not married at all. Now, Louise Troxell did marry an MD who was widowed, and she was more than in her 40s. She was maybe in her 50s or whatever, and that marriage didn't last. Louise Troxell Greeley. Mm-hmm. And then when Dr. Greeley married for the third or fourth time, I don't know which it was, fourth, I guess, his first wife died. Then he married her sister, and I don't know if she died or they were divorced. Then he married Louise Troxell, and then they were divorced. Then he married a younger woman who had been dating his son. I know all this because my friend Jerry Kaiser, his brother Phil, is married to Hannah Greeley. Mm-hmm. And so I paid special attention to a lot of this stuff. And I know that for a long time it was when Manchester's would send out their monthly bill to Mrs. Greeley, you know, they would get each other's bills mixed up.
And did his fourth marriage last?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, when you were in the classroom with male professors, did you feel, it sounds as though you felt comfortable in discussion. Mm-hmm. Did you in any way feel inferior? You must have been in the minority in numbers in the classroom as a woman student, or were you?
There again, I don't even remember mm-hmm. counting noses or wondering what the ratio was.
Which means it wasn't affecting you one way or the other, probably. Then. Yeah.
Now, during my first year in graduate school, which was the year of Pearl Harbor, by then the draft was on and men were beginning to vanish from the scene and or to appear in uniform, and then the ratio began to be upset with more females than males. But
the reason I ask you about your discussions is in graduate school today, for example, if there is a seminar with 50% men and 50% women, there is a tendency for the men to dominate the conversation unless the women are quite assertive and able to...
That's true everywhere. It's true at the lunch table where our faculty eat together.
So that's why I'm wondering...
We have enough sensitized men now after 3 or 4 years that they will call each other's attention to that, that they are interrupting and they are hogging the conversation. So I think we're making a little progress, but it's very slow.
So I'm wondering if you experienced that or if you recall experiencing that as a student.
I don't recall being uncomfortable about it. Now, it's very possible that I just accepted the fact that men talk more than women. On the other hand, I never felt silenced or as though I ought not to open mm-hmm. my mouth, mm-hmm. at least not because I was female. There were times when I didn't know what was going on, and then I knew enough not to open my mouth.
Which is actually a sign of intelligence. Okay. Well, let's continue this. You made a decision to major in political science. I might add that, and that was because it had the fewest requirements. My son is at the UW and made the same decision for the same reason among them. It still has the fewest requirements at the University of Washington.
So it just gave me more opportunity to pick other things. Mm-hmm. For example, the what I just mentioned with Helen Clark, the group work, mm-hmm. Theory and practice.
How long after that time was the School of Social Work started here?
Not too long. I can't remember the uh-huh. actual date, but uh-huh. Not too long after that. And when I came back here in the we moved back in 1960, and in the very early 60s, and when I was working in continuing education for women, I called together a little meeting with Dorothy Whitty Austin, who's a journalist from Milwaukee, who has worked for both of the Milwaukee newspapers, and whom I often refer to as the Boswell of the Wisconsin women's movement. She covered everything and anything and kept us on our toes by asking me in advance, what's going to be newsworthy at your meeting? Because if nothing is, I'm not going to bother to come. So then I'd have to think, aha, we better do something that's newsworthy. Anyway, I gathered together a few people, including Helen Clark and Ursula Masters, who was then head of the School of Social Work, and Dorothy Austin. I can't even remember who else was there, some other women on the faculty, to talk about the university's discrimination against women faculty, and just to ask what their experiences were. And both LeMasters and Helen Clark confirmed that the day Helen Clark bought a house in Madison, which would have been in the 1940s probably, she did not get another raise. Her salary was frozen at $8,000 because the head of the sociology department at the time, McCormick or E.A. Ross or one of those, I've forgotten who was, said she's not going to leave. Even if she gets a better offer, she's got a house here now. We don't have to pay her anymore. And so that was the way she was treated. Finally, LeMasters managed to get her, some many, many years later, get her salary up a bit, but it never amounted to what it should have.
So was that generally the rule that the women faculty made less money than the male faculty?
Oh, sure. In fact, that was going on in the 1960s when I came here to do the, and was doing the continuing education. That was one of the things we discovered. And when the Faculty Women's Association got organized, which I helped to organize, and first on the Madison campus and then the following year system-wide, that was one of the first things that we were concerned with, the fact that so many departments had no women at all, and that when they did have, they had them in as lecturers or as non-tenured people in one, and that the salaries at any level were, that there was a great gross disparity. And that battle isn't over yet.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'd like to hear more about that when we get to that time period. So you took social work classes, political science classes, continued with German, it sounds
just
like.
Just for 2 years. Of economics, sociology, I don't know what else, English, loved English. Again, Warner Taylor was my, I had to take freshman English. A lot of, in those days, people took a placement test, incoming freshmen took a placement test, and were exempt from freshman English. Didn't get 3 credits for it, but could move right into it. And I just assumed that I would be exempt from freshman English, and I was not. And it turned out that even though we thought we had a very good high school in Sparta, that we were not reading a lot of the more contemporary authors that I learned that, you know, over the first year or two in just visiting with my friends who would have read this, that, and t'other that I never had even heard of. So I realized that, at least in that department, my senior year in high school, that we had not had the same kind of preparation that a lot of other students. But I don't regret in the least having had that experience of having Warner Taylor as my English teacher, a full professor and a marvelous, marvelous person. And I thoroughly enjoyed and loved all the things that we read and learned how to kind of analyze and I think I learned as much about how to think about things in a somewhat analytic way from my English classes as I learned anywhere. And always in a very pleasant and painless way.
Do you recall favorite authors from that period? Anything that particularly stands out as No. Having been extraordinarily meaningful to you?
I remember writing a term paper on Robbie Burns that year, which I got a lot of wonderful comments and had a nice grade. And you know, in my office, I have that little poster that somebody gave me. You know, of course, God made man before he made woman. You always make a rough draft before you, you know, have mm-hmm. it finished. But I have asked people if they know the Robbie Burns poem. That is, and so many do not. I think feminists ought to put that on a poster, too. And I will be glad to recite all four lines to you.
Please do. I don't know it.
All nature sighs, the lovely deer. Her noblest work she classes, oh. Her prentice hand she tried on man, and then she made the lasses, oh.
How nice.
Yes, it's very nice.
Did you, and this is probably hard to remember, I'm wondering how many female authors were included in a literature class that period.
Again, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I didn't pay any attention to, I just can't. This morning I got a brochure in the office of some international thing on related to Nicaragua, and the first thing I noticed was 5 male speakers, not a single female speaker. And that now, of course, it just mm-hmm. is the first thing I noticed before I even notice what the subject is.
mm-hmm.
But I wasn't conscious of that at the time. Whether it was I'm sure it wasn't pointed out either. Now we're reading this, or this woman author has a different view.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Mm-hmm.
While you were an undergraduate, did you expect that you would go on for a master's and a PhD? Was that a given for you?
Not really. Even though my dad used to say that, you know, he would see us all through a master's, and after that we were on our own, I hadn't. I never have in my life planned ahead. That's very pro forma these days with counselors and advisors to women. Where do you want to be 10 years from now?
29th, Kay Clarenbach, side 2.
Now, we were talking about planning ahead, and did I plan
yes,
to have a
yes.
master's degree and a PhD? I think not. It must have been sometime during my senior year that I made a decision to go on the following year, at least for 1 year of graduate work.
What prompted that?
I don't know. I don't remember, at least.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that I applied for and received a scholarship, a cash award from the department, from the political science department, and then I was invited. I guess I didn't even know about house fellow jobs in the dormitory, but the dean of women's office asked me if I would like to apply, and which I did, and then I became what was called a house fellow in Elizabeth Waters' dormitory. That was fairly new. It was about its second year, I believe. And so I was one of 5 people in that dorm, and each of us had one unit with about 100 undergraduate girls whom we didn't supervise. We were just there to be help them organize stuff or to be there when they had a problem and wanted to talk about it. But I had free room and board at Elizabeth Waters. Marvelous food and a private room with a telephone and a view of the lake. It was just absolutely gorgeous, and a $400 cash award from the department. At the end of that year, I had $200 left from that $400, and that's what I lived on. That I still like to remember, that there was a beauty shop in the dormitory, and every Monday they had a special. For $1, you could get a shampoo and set and a choice of manicure or eyebrow arch. So every Monday I would have a $1 manicure, shampoo, and set.
You didn't have an eyebrow arch?
No. I didn't want anybody plucking at my hairs.
How did you like working with the young women? Were there any notable experiences there?
I'm not sure I was the world's greatest dorm fellow. I was always available, and if some people came in with a problem or they just wanted to gab, that was fine with me. But I very soon, in short order, decided I wasn't going to be available 24 hours of the day for just anybody to come in and gab. I was, after all, enrolled full-time in graduate school, including a course in statistics, which I regarded as one of the worst wastes of time because it took a lot of my time. I would figure out a problem and think I had it perfect and then realize I'd gone off on the wrong and have to do it over again, and have never used the mathematics that is what took all my time. I invested more time in that course than in all of the substantive courses that I took, put together. I, to this day, wonder why. You know, it's one thing to learn something about averages and the meaning of statistics when you read them, and it's another to work out those silly problems. Well, so I decided to post office hours when I was a house fellow. I think nobody else did that, but nobody told me I couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. I thought it was fair to the students to know when they could expect to find me there rather than to have them running up to my floor and finding I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. And I never snooped around. In those days, people were supposed to behave in a more decorous fashion.
Yes, what were the rules for the dormitory?
Well,
could boys visit to someone's room, for example?
Oh, my, no. No, there were parlors or lounges where they could visit at certain hours, only certain hours. And, of course, women students had hours in those days, 10:30 on weeknights and 12:30 on weekends, had to be in and were locked in. And boys had no hours, on the theory that once the girls were in, the boys would go home. That's the way it was explained. And
interesting.
Mm-hmm. So and there was a separate women's student self-government in those days. Women were also a part of the regular student government, but to make some of our own rules that governed females. I was never an active participant or an officer in WSGA, but Women's Self-Governing Association. But one of my very best friends was president. In fact, a couple of them were over the years. And trying to not only monitor and encourage adult behavior, mature behavior at least, but also to get some rules modified.
Mm-hmm. To change some of the repressive rules,
right.
More repressive.
And also to be sure that the women students who lived off campus or in rooming houses, mm-hmm, had proper accommodations and had some voice in student government. Mm-hmm. And just because they might be isolated, one or two or three in a house someplace, mm-hmm, shouldn't exclude them from things. So that there were a lot of good things that were going on. But it was after my time here that the rules were changed so that women could come and go.
Mm-hmm. If a young woman were to have gotten pregnant, would she have been able to stay in a dorm and stay in college? If she wasn't married, or even if she was married, was that something that would have been acceptable?
I knew several married women students who were pregnant, and there was no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I never knew a pregnant, unmarried person who stayed on the campus to the point where anybody knew she was pregnant. Uh-huh. Now, I don't know what was happening with abortions. I do know that one of the first things that the house fellows had was a meeting with a woman psychiatrist from the medical school, Nettie Washburn. And a great gal she was. And she just gave us tried to give us some insights into what kinds of behavior on the part of students might suggest that they ought to see an expert or a physician or whatever. Those were them. But she had some very enlightened and progressive views about sexuality and
did she talk behavior. About birth control or anything like that at that time?
Well, she did to us, but I don't know. And then we were supposed to have some, be able to pass some of this stuff along.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ever remember a student mentioning anything to me about birth control
or abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember when I was in the sorority house of girls being frantic, thinking they might be pregnant. I never was privy to any information from anybody about that.
Hmm. Did you know, did you ever hear gossip about abortionists, where they might be found? Was that wasn't information that
Not
went through
that.
Your grade?
Right.
What about violence against women at night on the campus, for example? Were women afraid of assault as they are today?
No. Walked anywhere. Of course, we had to be in at 10:30.
But it was dark.
Or at 12:30.
Uh-huh.
But even people in town who were not students,
mm-hmm.
who worked at other jobs, didn't seem to be worried.
Mm-hmm.
Buses cost a nickel in those days.
I was just going to ask about public transportation.
There wasn't a lot there were not a lot of bus lines, but it was adequate to the size of the place and the size of the population.
Mm-hmm. How about bicycles? Had they emerged yet in Madison?
No, not. Only a few queer ducks rode bicycles in those days. That was something for kids, or
I
something
see.
You did for recreation, but not a means of transportation.
Uh-huh.